Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Somali pirates are not just an exotic echo of bloody old tales from the high seas. They're a real problem right now. Bolder, more violent, more far-reaching than ever. In the last 10 days alone, four Americans were shot dead on their yacht, a Danish family now held hostage, and much bigger prizes taken. The pirates' territory is right on the path to the Suez Canal, where much of the world's oil traffic passes. They've got freighters and tankers hand over fist. This hour on Point, the pirates of Somalia and what can be done. You can join the conversation. How do you stop a pirate navy on top of the Suez Canal? If you've got to fix Somalia to fix the pirates, is it hopeless? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll get the latest from Libya and the revolution and pushback there. But first, joining me from Nairobi, Kenya, is Jeffrey Gettleman, East Africa, Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Jeffrey, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Just to begin with, what's the latest on this Danish family? How many? Where are they? What happened?
I think there's about five people. They were hijacked in the Arabian Sea a few days ago. They were sailing a very small yacht that isn't usually the choice of pirates. They like to go after bigger ships, especially oil tankers, because they bring the biggest ransoms. But from time to time, they'll strike at a yacht because it's easy to board. They're slow-moving. There probably aren't any private security people on board. So they took this yacht a few days ago, and what's alarming about this case is the pirates have taken several yachts in the past, but this may be the first time any children are in the hands of the Somali pirates, and nobody knows how that's going to play out.
There are three or four youngish teenagers in this Danish family that has now been taken.
That's right.
Give us a scale of the overall sort of prize take, if that's what we can call it, of these pirates. You've got yachts, you've got some little wooden dhows, but I'm looking here at a chart that was in your newspaper. All kinds of enormous vessels with enormous numbers of sailors on board, now in the, what, custody? Held for ransom by the pirates? The times.
Exactly. It's a much bigger problem than most people realize. There are something like 50 ships being held right now by Somali pirates, with a total of 800-plus crew members.
Incredible.
And this includes the United Nations of nationalities. There are Russians, there are Ukrainians, there are Filipinos, there are Africans from Kenya, Somalia, many African nations. There are now some Europeans, this Danish family. And they're being held in various parts along the Somali coast for ransom. And this is the business model. Pirates hijack these ships on the wide open seas, sometimes as far away as 1,000 miles from Somalia. They bring the ships back to the Somali coast. They usually take the people off, keep them on land, and then they wait for a ransom to be paid out. Now the ransoms have gone up to something like an average of $4 or $5 million, which is drawing many more young gunmen into the business.
And the range of the pirate attacks, I mean, just take the Americans on their yacht, the Quest. I mean, this thing was something like the distress signal came out 275 miles off the coast of Oman, not Somalia. They were in open water between Mumbai in India and Djibouti. That's a long way from the Somali coast.
Well, they've gone even farther. I've written about episodes where pirates have hijacked ships something like 1,200 miles away from Somalia, closer to India, actually. And the way they do this is they now employ motherships. And a mothership is a bigger ship that they've hijacked in the past that they use as a floating base. So they send the mothership far out to sea. It's got plenty of fuel and food to last for weeks. And then they tie small skiffs to that mothership. And when they see an approaching vessel, they dispatch the skiffs out into the ocean. The skiffs then approach the ship, attack it. These guys are armed with machine guns, RPGs, assault rifles. They take the ship hostage, and then they go back to the mothership, and then they sail back to Somalia.
The killing on the American yacht put a new element in here. I mean, normally they don't kill people because that's what they hold for ransom. Why did that happen? Your newspaper has raised questions about how that whole encounter between the U.S. Navy and these pirates on the American yacht went down.
Well, I think it's a really big mystery. It doesn't make any sense at all for pirates to kill their captives. That's their business model. They've raked in more than $100 million in the last year by ransoming back captives alive. So we don't really know what happened on that yacht. One unusual thing was that there were many pirates on board a relatively small vessel, and that's not usually how they like to do things. There were something like 20 armed gunmen on a 58-foot boat, and usually they send something like 10 or 15 guys to take an oil tanker that might be 1,000 feet long. So you had a lot of guys a lot of pirates on that boat, and then you had the U.S. Navy putting a lot of pressure on them, encircling them, flying helicopters over them, and I think what we saw was just some young and experienced pirates do something very stupid. Either they got angry at each other and they started shooting and the hostages were killed in the crossfire, or somebody got really frustrated and said, hey, you know, we're going to be arrested anyway, let's kill these hostages. But it's very unusual for the Somali pirates to intentionally kill hostages, and it's unprecedented to have four people killed like that in one episode.
There was an FBI hostage rescue negotiator on the Sterrett, the big Navy ship, among the others that was there. They took two of the pirates, the leaders, I guess, onto the U.S. naval vessel to, what, negotiate, threatened then to throw them into custody, kept them on there for a long time. Was the negotiation blown?
Well, it's really not clear what happened. There are no high-ranking pirates on the attack vessels. From my experience, I've been to Somalia many times.
Yep.
Interviewed some of these pirate bosses, these pirate kings. They hang back on shore. It's very risky to go out at sea and try to hijack a ship. You could drown. You could get arrested by a navy. You could be killed in the process. You could run out of food. We've heard all these type of stories from pirates about how risky it is. So the big bosses aren't going to be involved in the actual hijacking. So with this scenario with the Americans, I think it was relatively inexperienced, low-ranking guys. They did take two of them back to the Navy ship to negotiate, but it's not clear if they even knew what they were doing. And I think a lot of it had to do with the pressure that they were under and with that many pirates on board one small vessel.
When the confrontation finally came, and the climax, there were 15 Navy SEAL commandos storming that yacht. And as you say, four pirates, I think, two knifed dead, 13 surrendered to the Americans. Is that kind of attack only because there were American civilians on this yacht? Is this a sign of things to come? Could we have American military boarding these commandeered vessels more often, or is that a one-time only, Jeffrey?
No, well, it's both, actually. I think the reason why the American Navy responded so robustly was because there were four Americans, civilians, in danger in the hands of Somali pirates. That doesn't happen very often. But there have been many cases where the American Navy, which is part of this bigger coalition that's patrolling Somalia's waters, where they have boarded pirated vessels. And they've arrested pirates, and they've been in firefights with pirates. There's even been some cases where the pirates have mistakenly attacked naval warships because it was at night and they didn't see what they were doing, and they tried to board a warship and then got their butts kicked when the soldiers on board fired back. So in this case, it wasn't surprising that there was such a quick and aggressive response by the American Navy, but it seemed like things went awry in the negotiation phase.
As you say, there's an international armada out there now patrolling these waters. Why isn't that working?
Well, as you alluded to in the introduction, the problem is onshore. Somalia has not had a functioning government for more than 20 years. It is lawless. It's violent. It's awash with weaponry. There's no economy to speak of. So for a lot of people living in Somalia, there's very few opportunities to make an honest living. And in these coastal communities where people are well-armed and they're exposed to life as fishermen and they see these big ships passing by, they have decided that this is their way to make some money. So until you can really clamp down on the problems on shore, the immensity of the sea is such that you're never going to be able to perfectly police the ocean. It's just too big. They're now striking, like I said, more than 1,000 miles offshore. It's a total of more than 1 million square miles of water, which is the red zone now. So I just don't think anybody has a lot of hope that the naval response is going to make a big difference. The hope is that something will happen on land that will pacify Somalia, will provide some other economic opportunities, and people will be dissuaded from doing this this piracy business.
But Jeffrey, you know that Somalia has been insoluble for decades, as you say now. On the other hand, you've got this huge number, 50-plus ships, boats that have been taken, including big tankers and freighters. Is there a tipping point at which the international community feels like it has to go on land and do something, or does it just try and fight it offshore because Somalia is too intractable?
Well, that is the question. I felt like the death of the four Americans could be a game changer. It could really bring a lot of attention to this problem and show people that it's not just a nuisance, it's a lethal threat, that people who get kidnapped by pirates could be killed. But the problem is, okay, let's say there is a response by the international community to do something, you know, more aggressive and more thorough to tackle this problem. The question is, what are you going to do? For one, it's difficult to attack their bases on shore right now because they have 800 captives. Those people could be used as human shields. You go into one pirate community, they might start killing these captives. The other problem is that piracy is very organic in these areas. There are so many people involved. It's not just a handful of masterminds or a couple dozen gunmen. You have people that are working as skiff builders, mechanics, accountants, people that are supplying the ships with food and fuel. There are thousands of people in these coastal communities in Somalia that are tied to the piracy business.
It's an industry. Jeffrey Gettleman, we're up against the clock here. We really appreciate your time with us from Nairobi, Kenya, East Africa Bureau Chief there for the New York Times. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to deal with the Somali pirates. Little sound of that realm here. Last April, 1 year after the Maersk, Alabama, was attacked by Somali pirates, Captain Richard Phillips, American, spoke with ABC News Radio recounting his experiences when he was taken hostage for 5 days.
They put a blindfold on me and put a guy with a gun within a foot of my head. I kept on taking the blindfold off, and they'd smack me in the head. And I said, what are you going to do, shoot me? Because I told them, if they're going to shoot me, they'll be looking in my eyes.
Last week, four Americans dead on their yacht, killed by Somali pirates, apparently. Crossfire, I don't know, but after with the U.S. Navy sailing just out of reach there. Last week, Navy Vice Admiral Mark Fox described what happened when U.S. forces boarded the vessel.
There were two pirates that were dead on board the vessel when they boarded. As they were clearing it in below decks, there were two more pirates who were killed in the clearing process by the boarding team.
And it was all very messy. Four dead at the end. In January, CNN spoke with Gedi Mohamed Abdi, a former Somali pirate, who says that given the state of his country, becoming a pirate is the best career option.
There are no jobs and no money in Somalia. You either join the Al-Shabaab militia or government forces, or if you have relatives, you become a pirate.
We're going to dive on in here. With us now from London is Roger Middleton, consultant researcher for the Africa program at Chatham House, a London think tank that's all over the pirate problem. Roger Middleton, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much.
And with us from Washington is E.J. Hogendorn. He is Horn of Africa Project Director at the International Crisis Group. E.J., thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Roger, you heard the New York Times reporter, Jeffrey Gettleman, say things are reaching a new level, a new stage with the pirates. Do you agree?
It's certainly true that this is a problem which has been growing over the last 3 or 4 years, and it's certainly at a new level in that growth. We're looking at, you know, an area that is covered that is bigger than Western Europe. And, you know, we were thinking before a little bit about how do you patrol this area? Well, the navies have about 30 naval vessels at the best times to patrol that area. So this is a bit like trying to have a police force to cover the whole of Western Europe with only 30 cars. So it's almost impossible.
Wow.
But certainly it's growing, yeah.
Is there a point at which, I mean, for a long time, it looked like for the maritime industry, you just paid the ransom and went on about your business. It was part of the cost of doing the business. Is there a point at which that is no longer possible, acceptable?
Well, this is the interesting thing. You know, if you'd asked me last year or the year before, you know, what was a reasonable amount, or what did the maritime industry think was a reasonable amount of money to pay for a release? And we were looking at about $1 million to $2 million. That seemed to be not acceptable, but something that they could bear and that the insurers could bear. But this year we're seeing an average ransom in the region of about $5 million. Some of those payments have been, you know, closer to $10 million or very nearly $10 million. So the pirates are certainly pushing their luck. And I think what they've done and what they've shown over the last 10 years is that if they get paid $30,000 one day, they'll try for 40 the next. And if they get paid $1 million one time, they'll try for 1.5 or 2 million the next. And they haven't yet reached the point where shipping industry will say, no, we won't pay. And of course, there's the problem you talked about in your introduction about this being a route to the Suez Canal. Mm. And that's certainly true. But the fact is, the pirates cover such an enormous area now that if you're sailing from the Arabian or the Persian Gulf and you're going to China or to Japan, you need to sail down, you know, more or less along the coast of India. And that is now prime piracy territory. That is exactly where the pirates are operating. So there's very little area in the Indian Ocean that they're not threatening anymore.
E.J. Hogendorn, it's hard to take on board just the scope of this at this point. I mean, in the same week that the American yacht was taken, there was a Greek tanker taken, 2 million barrels of Kuwaiti crude on board worth $200 million. I mean, it was headed for Louisiana. That's a long way from Somali pirate country, but this is right in the middle of the Suez Canal entry now and all this trade that Roger's talking about. I mean, if the world should decide it's just not acceptable, what is the world up against in trying to solve it, EJ?
Well, that's a very good point. Our argument has always been that the problem with piracy will not be solved on the ocean, but that the problem with piracy will be solved on land. The reality is that the pirate kings that Jeffrey Gettleman spoke about are well-known individuals. And the reality is that those local authorities on the ground right now just don't have the political will to deal with these individuals and tell them that their activities are unacceptable.
Okay. What does it take, though, if you wanted to solve that? I mean, Somalia has resisted solving. It hasn't had a government since 1991. Do you have to fix the whole problem, or can you just go into the coastal towns and deal with, honchos there and somehow... I mean, how do you make it worth their while or, you know, too dangerous for them to be involved in this?
Well, I mean, obviously, you could certainly work with the coastal communities and tell them that, look, we will give you incentives if you don't allow the pirates to operate from your areas. What's really interesting about Somalia to some degree, though, is that there is this perception that the entire country doesn't function, and that's not true. Yeah. In fact, Somalia is best thought of as three separate zones of relative or instability, and that includes an area called Somaliland, There's an area called Puntland, and then there's South and Central Somalia, which is based around Mogadishu, where al-Shabaab is most active. And in
al-Shabaab
fact,
is the al-Qaeda-linked Islamic group that's been fighting for as much control as it can grab?
Correct.
If I've got
correct.
That right? Yeah.
Yes, right. And what's actually very interesting is that this area in northeastern or northwestern Somalia called Somaliland, they basically don't have a piracy problem. And the reason for that is because that region actually wants to be recognized as an independent country. And they've essentially said, look, we will be responsible because we want to be recognized as a responsible administration that's worthy of this recognition. Other areas in Somalia where there are local authorities that, you know, at least exercise some control, have essentially decided it's not in their interest to combat piracy most effectively. And in large part, it's because oftentimes they benefit from piracy themselves.
I mean, you make it sound, civically ordered and easy, but we know it's not. We heard on NPR just today, yesterday, a mind-blowing report out of Mogadishu, the sort of street-by-street, house-by-house fighting that's going on there. It's functioning, but the money that's backing these pirates, a lot of it's coming right out of the capital and big Somali financiers, right? Equipping these boats to go out and take the prize and share the dough. I hear you there, Roger. Yes?
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things there. I mean, one, of course, what EJ was saying there, you know, what's going on in Mogadishu is relevant in a sort of peripheral way, but it's not the key issue. When you're concerned about piracy, the key issue here is about the ability of the government in Puntland and a few other smaller entities just to the south of Puntland. This is the northeast part of Somalia.
Yep.
It's their ability to tackle piracy. And the focus on the transitional federal government in Mogadishu and the fight against al-Shabaab in South Central, that is, if you like it, it's vaguely connected, but it's a slightly different issue than this one of piracy. And then the second thing
May we pause on that, Roger, because everybody saw this recent report, I think it was from Reuters, saying that the pirates, or at least some significant portion of them, have now cut a deal with al-Shabaab, the al-Qaeda-linked organization, to share their takings with them, 20% of their prize money that would go into their pocket. And by that, I don't know, to al-Qaeda? I mean, that doesn't sound like just a local issue.
Well, I mean, if you look at this, if you're trying to operate any kind of business in Somalia, whether you're importing televisions or you're exporting cattle or you're running a criminal business like piracy or gun running, you're going to have to negotiate with the political and military actors in the area that you're operating in. So if you're a pirate and you're operating a bit south of Puntland in an area where Shabaab are beginning to get some influence, although still not, you know, not completely in control there, you will have to pay some kind of bribe to them. But I don't think this should be interpreted as a way of saying, you know, pirates and Shabaab are working together. And also, we should be a little bit careful about this Reuters report as well, I think. I'm not sure. We can take it as given. But, you know, that's how business is done in Somalia. You need to make sure that the people with the guns are not going to interrupt you. And that's one of the reasons pirates have been happy to operate in this area, Puntland, in the northeast, because in a way, Puntland is stable enough. You're not dealing with fighting every day. You're not dealing with, you know, competing armed groups in terms of deciding who you have to bribe. But it's also got a weak enough government that you can run a criminal operation like this, and that you can bribe, you know, you can bribe politicians and military figures, and they will leave you alone. So that's the kind of the perfect solution for pirates.
Action and guns on the high seas here, and politics and guns on land. I want to go to our listeners, Stephen, in Branchburg, New Jersey. Thanks for calling, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm concerned this really has become an industry. And I think there is a parallel to the way that extortion money, protection money, was extracted from the nations of the world by the Barbary pirates. And, of course, we did end up going to war with them. I think a response, you know, has to...
Thomas Jefferson times.
Stick.
Yeah. Okay, so like what?
Well, one thing, I think we should internationalize this. I don't think the U.S. should go it alone. And one thing I'd like to hear your guests mention is the... action taken recently by South Koreans, who I understand staged a fairly successful commando rescue effort. And in fact, South Korea has had some special forces capability for a long time that we've never really seen them use.
Yeah, that was a long way from Korea. Let us look at that one, Stephen. Roger Middleton, what about that story? Lots of South Korean shipping and ransoms paid, but then not so long ago, just a couple of weeks now, we heard the story of their commandos boarding and taking a ship back. What about that as a model? What lessons there?
It's a good point that Thomas raised there. You know, a lot of the anti-piracy activity, naval activity, is actually being run by the European Union, by NATO, but also we see countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia sending ships to do patrols there, including, of course, China as well. So it is an international problem being addressed internationally as well. I think the South Korean instance is interesting. Previously, just about a week or 2 weeks before, the South Korean vessel had paid the highest ransom ever, $9.5 million, for the release. So certainly I think there might have been some political motivation in South Korea to be seen to not be being soft on piracy. But the reality is that, you know, those kind of rescue operations are very risky. And of the rescue operations we've seen, the French have done a couple of rescue operations. And in one of those, it was a little bit similar to the ones we're seeing at the moment with the yachts. A French couple had been captured on a yacht with their baby and their friend. And French commandos went in to rescue them. And unfortunately, the captain of that yacht was killed by the French commandos during the rescue. So it is very, very risky to do those kind of rescues. And that's why we don't see them very often, only in very extreme circumstances. So I think certainly... when they can be done, they can be very effective. Dutch forces did one not that long ago, when they knew that the crew were safe and locked in a room where so they could shoot without fear of killing hostages. Of course, once the pirates have the hostages, they have a human shield, and that's a very dangerous and risky situation.
Let me get a call from Elliot in Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Elliot, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make two comments. First of all, this thing has been going on for a long time. And I can't believe, with all the intellects we have all over the world, all the very simple people, all the in-between, somebody hasn't come up with a solution. I'm going to give my solution, but
okay.
I'll make my second comment first.
Mm-hmm.
If this was happening in China, believe me, it wouldn't go on for 1 month. They would find a way. They're very headstrong. They're very, I don't know all the guys.
Hey, Elliot, let me. I want your solution, but on that point, I mean, it's not as though the United States is not headstrong. We invaded, you know, Iraq. We're in Afghanistan. It's not as though we haven't been willing to go in militarily, but
no,
do you really want to go into Somalia?
I'll tell you my solution.
Okay.
My solution is that we establish an international escort service, so to speak, where every nation gets together and say, enough, enough, this is it. Nobody's going to keep us hostage. It's like a teenager telling their parents how they're going to run the show.
Elliot, we've got it. Roger, is that economical? Could you do it? Just put enough naval vessels out there that you escort everybody through this region and the pirates are afraid to attack?
Yeah, I mean, I think the frustration Elliot feels is the same that everybody feels about this problem. The reality, as we've mentioned many times, is really the only way to stop this is effective government on land. And just to deal with this idea of an escort service, at the moment there is a sort of proto-escort service, very small one, that runs through the Gulf of Aden off the north coast of Somalia. And that is very effective. And it's run by the European Union and NATO. And essentially what they do is provide zones of protection that you can sail through.
Mm-hmm.
And it works very well. The problem is, Elliot, we're dealing with an area which is, as we said, the size of Western Europe. You're dealing with something like 30 or 40 or maybe even 50,000 ships going through it every single year. And the reality is there just isn't enough capacity in the world's navies to cover this. If I give you an example, the former head of the EU naval mission to Somalia said to me that to properly police the Indian Ocean where the pirates are operating, you'd need something like 600 naval vessels to do it and make sure there were never any attacks. The US Navy, you know, the biggest, best paid, most sophisticated navy in the world, has something like 250 ships. And obviously they are busy with Afghanistan, Iraq, and all other kinds of priorities that they have. And I think that reminds us what the real issue here is, both for piracy and actually more importantly for the problems in Somalia. You know, Somalia just isn't up there in terms of international priorities in the way that a problem like Afghanistan is.
But it's climbing on the back of exactly this problem. Here's another suggestion from Syed. He says, treat the pirates like any other criminal organization. Send out bait boats that look like any other cargo ship or oil tanker. Have special forces or CIA agents waiting to strike them. What about that, Roger?
I think things like that have been tried. They've also tried going in close to the Somali shore with naval vessels and picking up the pirates as they come off. And all of these things can be done, and they can be effective. But in the end, you arrest 12 pirates. And even if you manage to find somewhere where you can put those pirates on trial and, you know, take them out of action, if you like, for a while, the reality is that, you know, in the long run, this is such a profitable business. You know, a young man who is a pirate, so a foot soldier, if you like, he will make from one successful hijacking about $10,000. If he stays in Somalia, he can expect to, if he works in a militia, for example, also an incredibly dangerous job. If he's lucky, he might make $100 a month. More likely, he'll make $300 or $400 in the whole year. So you can see the economic incentive to be a pirate is enormous. And that's why you have people coming from all over the Somali-speaking regions of East Africa wanting to be pirates. So it's not as if we take a few of them out, there won't be more to take their place. So certainly those kind of tactics are good. But they only help deal with the problem. If we want to address the cause of this, it has to be finding a way to convince the government in Puntland, in some other small areas, like called Galmudug and others, that they need to tackle piracy at source, that they need to send their police forces into the pirates' houses and arrest them before they leave Somalia.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about how to deal with the Somali pirates with E.J. Hogendorn of the International Crisis Group. He's the Horn of Africa Project Director there, joining us from Washington, and Roger Middleton at Chatham House in London, who has looked very closely at this. He's author of the briefing paper, Piracy in Somalia, Threatening Global Trade, Feeding Local War. For a link to a really interesting graphic, New York Times graphic, showing the tally of vessels and passengers and crew held off the coast of Somalia and on it, go to our website, onpointradio.org, and we will look at the situation in Libya in just a few moments as well. EJ, I want to come to the situation on land, but let me get a couple of these callers in here first, if I may. Saad in Los Angeles, California. Saad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. We have no shortage of air bases and aircraft carriers in the region. Just a hypothetical situation. If, for example, a pirate vessel threatens one of these commercial ships, can these ships send a signal, let's say an SOS signal, to one of these aircraft carriers where they send an airplane, basically a fighter, threaten the pirate vessel? If they don't seize their threatening mode, then they shoot them.
So defense from the air. Yeah, we've got it, Saad, and it's related. I got another one here online from Phil in Connecticut who says it seems a perfect scenario for monitoring by remote control drones that could cover and fire missiles. Roger, what about it? I mean, pirates don't emerge from nowhere. You see them coming on the ocean. It takes time for them to approach.
Yeah, I mean, both those suggestions are things that are being done. There are, unmanned drones going around the Indian Ocean looking for pirates. Problem is, again, though, you're dealing with this huge area, and you have to remember that if there are American or other Navy resources in the area, very often their primary concern is with the war in Afghanistan, and they're being used as a launch pad for operations there or whatever. So there is a very limited amount of those kind of resources available to the people leading these anti-piracy
operations.
But how many
jets or drones would it take if they were, based somewhere near this area?
It would take
a
lot. I mean, you have to remember the time it takes, generally, the average time from a captain of a ship noticing that there's a pirate boat coming towards him to being boarded is only 15 minutes. So even with high-speed jets, to get them off an aircraft carrier or to get them to leave Djibouti or Mombasa or wherever they are, you're almost looking at, 5 minutes just to get off the ground before they get there. So if there's a ship just over the horizon that has a helicopter or has planes on board, they can come to your rescue in time. But if they're not, then it's going to be too late. And that's the real problem. That's why, for commercial shipping, they need to make sure they're as hard to hijack as possible. And that gives the navies more of a chance to get there to help them.
Michael in Boston. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, John. Hi, Tom. Yeah. It seems to me that the political situation is going to take a long time to fix here in Somalia. These vessels are armed and contractors are on the vessels themselves in order to repel these pirates, the pirates are a lot less likely to attack vessels that are armed. I don't understand why international law will not allow the arming of these vessels.
One more for you, Roger, then we'll go to EJ. But I remember from talking about this before that, companies' ports don't want armed vessels coming in when they arrive at the other end. But maybe this is a case where it's required. What would that take, Roger?
No, well, there are some companies which will use armed private security, but there are a whole range of issues with this. There's a real problem that often the port you're going to at the other end, they would see this as armed smuggling and arrest you. But then there's a really big problem that many of the companies that operate these kind of private armed security off the coast of Somalia are, if you like, these are fly-by-night companies. These are not regulated in any way, shape or form, and it's very dangerous and risky. And we've seen the problems in Iraq with Blackwater, for example, and companies like that, they really don't have they're not always it's not always a good idea to be getting yourself mixed up with those. There's also a real concern from ship owners that if you have people on board with guns, the reaction of the pirates to your crew, if they manage to take control, is going to be much more violent, much more vicious, and much more likely to end up with people being killed. So I think in a very few cases, there may be some arguments for private security, armed private security, but generally speaking, it's something to be thought about incredibly carefully because there are some very serious risks. I mean, just for example, think about being on board a liquid gas carrier with a gun. If a spark in the wrong place and you have an enormous mess. So it's a very dangerous and risky.
Here's Chia on the web. She writes, it seems unbelievable that these small pirate skiffs take over huge tanker ships. She says, arm them, just shoot the guys. As far as the American and Danish yachts, she says, it's my opinion that it was very risky to be in that area, knowing there are pirates there. They brought it on themselves. EJ, here's a comment from Ekapuro who says, hang them or have them walk the plank. It worked before. It'll work again. What about, the legal action? I mean, they're being brought back and tried in the United States, some of them now. So somebody was just sentenced to 30-some years in an American prison. Is that going to deter pirates in Somalia, EJ?
Well, again, I think as Roger has noted before, the pull factor, so to speak, is so enormous for these destitute Somalis that they're willing to take significant risks, including dying, out in the open ocean, for the potential reward. There has been actually a lot of international efforts to try to come up with some kind of a legal regime to try pirates and then incarcerate them. The problem, of course, is that there's been a large question about where do these pirates actually end up. And that's been an enormous challenge.
They've talked about making grappling hooks and the pirate equipment illegal, so you could arrest them just for carrying the kit.
Well, I think the biggest problem is, just to answer some of the questions that your listeners have posed, these motherships basically look like any other ship that's sailing in the Indian Ocean. And as Roger has also said, I mean, these are incredibly busy waters. So if you see a fishing vessel, you assume it's a fishing vessel until, what happens is they launch these skiffs, and within 15 minutes, these skiffs are boarding your ship. So there's a huge element of surprise. These ships are not sailing around with a black flag and the skull and crossbones flying from the mast. So, again, it becomes a huge challenge identifying pirates.
Just to know who they are. And then you've got that very, very long Somali coast all around the Horn of Africa there. So take us to land, EJ. If the solution is on land, I mean, Americans have bitter memories of what it was like to be engaged militarily in Somalia, Black Hawk Down and all that, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, both had really rough times there. What would it take to address the situation on land in a way that would undercut piracy at sea?
Well, again, we certainly aren't advocating for an international intervention that will, try to reimpose law and order in all of Somalia. What we really think is what needs to happen is the incentives need to be put in place that the local authorities that do control those areas say, look, this is an activity we don't want to see happening and that we want to prohibit. The interesting thing really is, as I mentioned before, there are actually areas where piracy is essentially not happening. And there have also been periods in the past where piracy has essentially been stopped. There was actually a very interesting case about 4 years ago when you had something called the Islamic Courts Union, which took control of Mogadishu and then ultimately of all of South and Central Somalia. And they basically said, look, piracy is illegal under Sharia law, and we prohibit it. And guess what? Within a month, most of those pirates disappeared.
But now Al-Shabaab is on the payroll. I mean, they're sharing in this. They're probably not likely to cut it off.
Well, I share Roger's skepticism of that report. There are some indications that there may be isolated Al-Shabaab groups that have come up with, how can you say that, arrangements of convenience where basically they have agreed that they'll leave each other alone in exchange for a cut of the profits. But there's very little evidence right now to suggest that the Al-Shabaab leadership is countenancing this and that this is something that they actually want to get involved with.
But with $9 million ransoms out there, it seems to me there's little evidence as well that a Sharia court's going to come into these coastal regions where the town fathers are in on the business. It's the only game in town in many of them, and tell them to stop. The money's so big.
Well, that's a very good point. Again, what you need to do is you need to come up with the appropriate carrots and sticks to tell people that, this is just not acceptable. And again, just to reiterate, there are certain areas in Somalia where they've basically determined it is in our interest, the interest of the authorities, to in fact stop this activities because they see it otherwise threatening more important goals. And I hate to say it, but the international community is spending a great deal of money on Somalia in terms of development assistance, humanitarian assistance, and so forth. And those are very enticing carrots for people who actually are in charge and who are really in a position to stop this activity from continuing.
But I'm just not following. If we're spending a great deal of money there already, you say it's a big carrot, but it's not working at all. What carrot would work? What stick might work?
Well, what we've argued in our latest report is that, unfortunately, the international community has been focusing almost exclusively on the so-called transitional federal government, which really only controls a number of districts in Mogadishu. Somalia is much more complicated than that, and there are, in fact, all these disparate local authorities that we've discussed throughout the hour that actually do control territory. The problem is that right now we aren't giving them any assistance or any incentive to actually deal with things like piracy or other issues that are important to us.
It doesn't sound like we're going to solve Somali piracy today. What a big challenge. But you've given us some maybe starting points in how to think about it as these big numbers of pirates and dollars fly around here. Really incredible. E.J. Hogendoorn with the International Crisis Group joining us today from Washington. Thank you very much for your time, E.J.
My pleasure.
And Roger Middleton at Chatham House in London. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Watch out. If you're sailing in that neck of the woods, maybe don't sail there if you can help it. In a moment, we go to Libya for the latest. This is On Point. Revolt, counterattack, and struggle in Libya right now. Rebels under pressure as Muammar Gaddafi defies calls to go. Oh, we're about to turn to the Libyan capital and Tripoli and Martin Fletcher there of the Times of London, but I think we have just lost that line. We'll see if we can get it back here. We're dialing back right now. The headlines out of Libya, pretty rough over the last 24, 48 hours here. Rebels, of course, taken the eastern part of the country, Benghazi, and well beyond. They were right on the doorstep of Tripoli and remain there until very recently. Gaddafi, though, defiant, digging in and fighting back. The latest headline here, rebels in Libya win the battle but fail to loosen Gaddafi's grip right on his doorstep there, and reports of attacks from air and maybe sea on some of the rebel-held positions in the east of the country. He's still been speaking even as of yesterday, vowing to fight to the last man, whatever that may mean. Martin Fletcher joins us now from Tripoli in Libya. Martin, thank you very much for joining us. What is Gaddafi's situation at this point, and what about the rebels, Martin?
Well, there are not many rebels in Tripoli, not that you can see. It's really interesting. There's been a complete sea change in the mood over the last day or two. A week ago, when I first arrived here, you could go into the neighborhoods and people were openly denouncing Colonel Gaddafi in a way that I'd never seen before in Tripoli. They were even prepared to put their names to their comments. Now, no one will do that. The curtain of fear has descended again. There is a sort of mask that Libyans put on, and it's very hard to penetrate. You ask how things are, and they say they're fine, everything's normal, we're happy. You know that they don't believe that, but that's what they say. And they're very suspicious. They see who's following you, who's with you. Sometimes if you sit down with them and you talk for a long time and you talk in a certain amount of code, you can break through that mask, and they begin to give a little away, but they're extraordinarily cautious, and once again, they're very fearful. I think most people in the capital have decided that Gaddafi is not going to go, at least in the near future, and that it's safer to keep their heads down.
Martin Fletcher, this leaves us with a situation where Gaddafi has killed many of his own people. Something like half of the country appears to be under some kind of rebel control, and the international community has condemned him and says he has to go. So how does this resolve, Martin?
Well, that's the big question. I don't know. You do have a country in two halves now, completely split. Gaddafi has problems over the longer term. The biggest one, I think, is the economy. He has lost control of a lot of Libya's oil revenues. Leave aside the fact that oil production has slumped by more than a half, that almost all the foreign oil workers on which the industry depends have left. A lot of the oil fields in the east, which he no longer controls, he's lost most of the sort of foreign labor that keeps his place ticking over. His sources of revenue are drying up. His overseas assets have been frozen. It's hard to see where he's over, I'm talking now for over months, his revenues are going to come from. Without the revenues, how does he keep his people happy?
We've seen many defections in the diplomatic corps and in the Libyan military. Who's still with Muammar Gaddafi? What's his base of strength now?
Well, I think it's a mistake to think that Gaddafi doesn't have quite a lot of support, especially the further west you go in the country. And in Tripoli itself, he still does have quite substantial support. There are legions of people who did very nicely from his regime's largesse and quite genuinely wants him to stay on. By the same token, there are allegiance of people who would love to see him go. It's very volatile. But for the time being, in the capital at least, he's reimposed his reign of fear, and he looks pretty stable here. And so long as he kind of controls the capital, it's hard to see how he can be removed.
So how do you read the balance of power then? Are we into a civil war scenario? Can the rebels sustain in the east if Gaddafi holds in the west in Tripoli or not?
Well, Gaddafi has tried to retake one or two towns, both in the west and the east, and without very much success so far. The rebels have acquired a certain amount of weaponry. They have an extraordinary courage, I have to say. It's pretty much a stalemate at the moment. I mean, we flew in last week thinking maybe we're getting, a lot of us had seen Mubarak fall, and we were pinching ourselves and saying, are we really going to witness Gaddafi and Mubarak both going in a month? But I think among the Western journalists here, there's now a sense that we could be here for weeks and months, and this thing will drag on without any obvious resolution.
Martin, do you hear very briefly from Libyans who expect or desire international intervention or not?
Actually, no. I hear the opposite. I hear that the one thing that is driving people back towards Gaddafi is the idea of foreign intervention. It arouses their nationalism, their patriotism. They want to resolve this themselves.
Amazing. Stalemate in Libya, perhaps. Martin Fletcher is associate editor of the Times of London. He joined us from Tripoli. Martin, thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.